Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It's 1:36 on the afternoon of Friday, February the 10th, 2012, and we have a quorum here to do business. Senator Coghill's here, myself, Senator French, Senator Pascman, and Senator McGuire. We have three matters before us today. SB 135, continuances in criminal trials, SB 140, cathinone bath salts, and SB 186, sentencing and probation. I'm hoping to adopt CSs in the first two and look to the will of the committee. The last is on its first presentation, and it's a lengthy bill, so we'll certainly be holding that over. Let's turn to SB 135. It is a bill relating to the rights of crime victims, relating to the duties of prosecuting attorneys, and amending Rule 45. And the member should have a CS before you backslash M like Mike. We could have a motion to adopt the CS.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I had moved that we move the CS for Senate Bill number 135 version backslash M before this committee for purposes of discussion.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the CS is before us. And we have, we'll get an explanation of changes in the CS from my staffer, Lila Hobbs. Lila, why don't you come forward? Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record and tell us how this version M is different than the version we considered last time.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lila Hobbs, staff to Senator French. The CS for SB 135 makes four minor changes to the bill. If you page 4, lines 12 through 15, Section 2 amends AS 1261015A5. By providing a definition of substantially delay, explicating it in the instances of a misdemeanor, felony, and an appeal. For a misdemeanor, it would mean a delay of 1 month or longer. For a felony, it would be a delay of 2 months or longer, and for an appeal, it would be a delay of 6 months or longer. Further down on page 4 on line 24, section 3 is amended by removing the word. Still looking at page 4 on line 25, section 3 is amended once again to add the words, if known, to account for the instances where the victim cannot be contacted or does not wish to participate. This provision ensures that the bill does not inadvertently cause delay when trying to send notice of a request to a victim that may be reachable or not want to receive notifications. On page 5, on line 4, section 4 is amended by adding the words, if known, to account for the aforementioned circumstances.
Hobbs, or if you can direct them to me if you have questions about the CS. Have Ms. Carpinetti come forward, because some of these changes were brought about a hest of the Department of Law in the last hearing. And so, Ms. Carpinetti, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Our suggestions were, and I hope I'm not speaking out of school, they were suggested by Ms. Nancy Mead.
Oh, okay.
In terms of the rule change. And we agree with it, adding the terms, if known, because you don't want to delay a hearing, you can't get a hold of the victim, and that is often the case. You can't get a hold of the victim. And then our suggestion was to provide guidance as to what is substantial delay. And these are our suggestions, and we appreciate your adding them. Thank you.
Incorporating them, yeah, it's a committee process. I thought they were all good ideas. It helps sort of give the judge some idea. It still sort of puts a little more teeth into this desire on my part and on the part of many victims' organizations to have a little more consideration given to their wishes when continuances are granted. So any questions from the committee for Ms. Carpenter? That is before us. Members have any comments, considerations, amendments to offer? Don't hear or see any. How about a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move the CS for Senate Bill 135 backslash M version from this committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations, and I believe it has a new fiscal note. I believe it's zero or indeterminate.
101 indeterminate.
Yes. So as identified.
Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the bill will move, and let's take a short break for the paperwork. We're back on the record, and next up is CS for Senate Bill number 140. Like the last bill, we have a CS before the committee. Should be /I, India. We could have a motion to adopt that CS.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the CS is before us, and we have a staffer from the sponsor's office, Ms. Marsegan. Welcome to the committee. Nice to see you, and you can explain what the CS does.
For the record, my name is Christine Marsegan, staff to Senator Kevin Meyer. The CS before you makes several changes that basically deal with the penalties and also takes care of a drafting issue. In Section 1, it deals with the distribution, manufacturing, possession of 500 milligrams or more of the substance to remain classified as a misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fourth degree, a Class C felony. So it basically keeps this drug in Schedule 2A. But in Section 2, any possession of the drug under 500 milligrams is classified as an A misdemeanor, which would mean a year in jail and up to $5,000 fine. 500 milligrams is approximately about the size of a packet of sugar. And since there's been testimony about the how powerful these drugs are, we thought that was appropriate. In Section 3, there was a technical amendment. What happened when the drafters were looking at this again is that they noticed that one of the drugs that was on the list that we're adding to this was already classified as Scheduled 1A. It was felt that that particular drug fits in better with the cathinones, and so that was moved from Schedule 1A and put in 2, and the repeal language is in Section 4.
Very good. And which one of these was the 1A of the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 varieties I have on page 5? Do you know?
It's on lines 10 and 11. And okay. That particular drug was, it's also called something else, but it's the same drug. And I do have correspondence with Orrin Dim from the crime lab saying that it's the same exact thing.
Okay. And I won't make you say it because I certainly can't say it. And
Find me, sir.
It's an absolute mouthful, but it is there on lines 10 and 11. So thank you. So essentially, we keep manufacturing, delivering, and possessing large amounts at a felony. We take the possession of small amounts down to a misdemeanor, and that's basically what the CS does.
That is correct, sir.
Questions for the Ms. Marsegan? Senator Passman.
What's the value of 500 milligrams of one of these substances? So we get, you know, obviously we're, those are the felonies, and so, you know, what's the transaction size?
Senator Pascan, through the chair, my understanding is that a small packet of this particular substance would be about $40.
So if I understand your answer right, $40 single dose would be a misdemeanor under this bill, but anything more than that's going to be a felony.
That is correct, sir.
Okay. Well, that's a high penalty for still a fairly small amount. But, you know, I talked to Senator, bill sponsor, Senator Meyer, about this. And it's interesting because we were reflecting on what we did last year with spice, and he was concerned that, you know, not concerned, but we just had a good discussion about, you know, and I think he supports this CS, but wanted to be sure that we weren't sort of treating this more gently than we treat spice. And I reminded him that with the spice bill, we actually wound up with the smallest amount of possession being a B misdemeanor, so being less than what we're offering here. So this possession of a small amount of the bass also be an A misdemeanor, a year in jail, B misdemeanor is 90 days. So still a fairly substantial penalty for the possession of a very small amount, up to a year in jail, absent any other charges like assault or destruction of property and so forth that might come along with the intoxication under this material. Further questions? Don't see any. We've closed public testimony. What's the will of the committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move CS for Senate Bill 140 out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved. It will take a short at ease and come back with the criminal bill before us. Back on the record. Last up is SB 186, a committee bill filed at the in conjunction with the administration, or at least to help them out. It's a fairly lengthy bill, and we're going to get an overview of it from Ms. Carpinetti. Welcome to the committee. Welcome back.
Thank you. I have to get my binder, but thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. And first, I want to thank you for sponsoring this bill for us. Rick Sabodney, my boss, and I were talking last night about a way to make this bill interesting, and we couldn't come.
You know, I probably spent 2 hours reading this very, very carefully over the summer. I got myself all up to speed on it, made a bunch of decisions, and then came down here and had to revisit them. Had to spend 2 hours again because you just have to bear down on it. Once you get it in front of you and in front of you, you can make a decision. But unless you work with it every day, it's tough stuff.
So. It is, and it is for me too. Every time I look at it again, I have to go back and read some cases to help me out. But fortunately, I have lawyers in OSPA who are really cooperative, and they help me out. So I'm going to try and make it as quick as possible, even if it's not particularly interesting. But to set it in historical context, in 2004, the United States Supreme Court decided Apprendi versus New Jersey, and then in 2000 Apprendi was decided, and then Blakely versus Washington was decided in 2004. And these two United States Supreme Court decisions, they held that if a factual determination was made in a criminal prosecution that had the possibility of raising the maximum penalty for punishment for a person who was convicted of a crime, the Sixth Amendment requires that that factual determination be made by a jury, unless waived, by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. This decision required major changes to our sentencing law, not only in Alaska, but in many other states, too. We had to change our presumptive sentencing laws, which in 2005, the legislature did make major changes in our presumptive sentencing laws, in our sentencing scheme. And, for example, adopting presumptive ranges rather than specific presumptive sentences. Since 2005, there have been bills, as we've learned more about, and decisions have been made by courts of appeal that have required more changes to comply with these decisions. And here we are at this, again, dealing with the fallout of these two very important court decisions. We hope this is the last one, but I wouldn't bet the farm on it. Anyway, so most of the provisions in the bill do address the constitutional requirements of these two decisions. They are actually law in our state now because we are bound by those decisions, and they make our statutes comply with those two decisions. The first three sections deal with a person who has been found guilty of a crime by the fact finder, but the issue of whether or not that person is also mentally ill has been raised. And our law allows, after a finding of guilt, for the court to address this issue. So what it does is, because our law provides that a person who is found guilty but mentally ill is not entitled to mandatory parole, sometimes called good time. That's an easier way to understand it for me. Is not entitled to good time. Most other people have the right to mandatory parole or good time. But if you are convicted and found guilty but mentally ill, you don't have the right to mandatory parole until your health is improved to the point where you can be found not dangerous to yourself or others or to the public. So the possibility of a person being found guilty but mentally ill and not getting mandatory parole requires then that the finding of guilty but not mentally ill must be made by the jury, unless weighed by the defendant, by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So the first three sections of this bill address those issues of a person in those circumstances. There is one additional provision that was suggested by the public defender, and I think it's a good one. In Section 2, we added the provision that a party needs to file notice 10 days in advance of trial if they think that might come up after trial. The issue of guilty but mentally ill might arise after trial. So that's Sections 1, 2, and 3. And as I said, this doesn't change the law that we have to enforce right now. It just changes our statutes to comply with the Supreme Court's decisions. Section 4 is really a pretty much of a conforming amendment. Right now, when Title AS 1255 was enacted, when our sentencing schemes were enacted, most factual determinations were made by a preponderance of the evidence, and the statute said that with some exceptions. Now there are so many requirements in our sentencing law that require burdens different from preponderance that we just made it clear that there are a lot of places that you should need to look at this specific law. Section 5 and Section 6 and the conforming sections 10 and 11. Let us take a time out from Blakely and Apprendi, because this does not deal with Blakely and Apprendi. It deals with a decision made by the Court of Appeals in Henry versus State and Fulton versus State. And it's a case that we think was mistakenly decided by that court, and we are asking you to consider changing the law in that regard.
This is 6 and 10.
5 and 6 and 10 and 11 are the conforming conform Title 33 statutes with Sections 5 and 6. In general, most cases decided by, processed through the criminal courts are determined by Rule 11 plea agreements. And usually a person is charged with certain crimes, and the defendant and the prosecution, their lawyers get together and decide, justice will be served if the state reduces a certain charge or dismisses a certain charge, and the defendant pleads guilty and gives up his or her right to a jury trial, and they come to a bargain and they reach a sentence agreement. Usually it's a time to serve in jail with sometimes suspended and a period of probation while that suspended time occurs. So the prosecution, as part of the bargain, makes concessions, and so does the defendant. I'll tell you what the Court of Appeals decided in the Henry and Fulton cases. They decided they. Well, maybe it would be more helpful to give you the facts of the case. I'll do that. I'm sorry. Mr. Henry was charged with felony drunk driving. I think it was out of Fairbanks. And he was also charged at the same time with driving with a revoked or suspended operator's license, failure to stop at the direction of a police officer, and driving without motor vehicle insurance. The state and Henry and the state entered into a plea agreement, a Rule 11 plea agreement, where the state dismissed three charges, the driving with a revoked operator's license, failure to stop at the direction of a peace officer, and driving without insurance. The defendant agreed to plead guilty to felony drunk driving, and the sentence was agreed on, which was 24 months in prison with 19 months suspended, so a period of 5 months to serve, a fine, mandatory fine, and probation for a period of 3 years. Mr. Henry specifically agreed to these terms, as did the state when he was sentenced. He then served his 5 months, probably 3.5 months with good time, and was released. And within 2 weeks of his release, he was found, and one of the conditions of probation was that he not consume alcohol. He was found in possession of alcohol, and his blood alcohol was 0.245. So he had, you know, seriously violated the conditions of probation. At the hearing, the state filed a motion to revoke probation, and at the hearing, the defendant told the court that he didn't want to be on probation anymore. He didn't like being on probation. And the court, over the state's objection, sentenced him not to the 19 months that were suspended, but to 15 months, and eliminated the rest of the probationary period. And the Court of Appeals reasoned that the court, when looking at a case again, should be able to use the Cheney criteria in sentencing him again, because it's, you know, a little bit later, not in this case, not very much later, but a little bit later, in determining how much time should be imposed on a petition to revoke probation. And actually, we agree that with this part of the decision that the court should look to the sentencing criteria in Cheney to determine how much time should then be imposed for the probation violation. But we don't agree with the decision of the court to unilaterally end probation and reduce the period of suspended time. I mean, the court certainly could suspend only or impose again only 15 months of the time that was suspended, but they should not have just unilaterally stopped probation, because this man is a danger to society. He's a felony drunk driver, and obviously Will has no compunction about drinking again and possibly driving again. He did it without a license in the first place. So we had good reasons for the bargain we entered into. We thought he was dangerous and should be on probation and not be drinking for at least 3 years. And, you know, you might recall, being a former practitioner of criminal law, not only does the prosecution and defendant have to agree on a plea bargain, the judge has to also agree before it is imposed. So sections 5 and 6 provide that if there's been a criminal Rule 11 plea agreement and both sides agree to a certain amount of probation and suspended time, that the court should not be able to unilaterally change these without permission. And there are times when the prosecution will agree with a change of conditions. But under these circumstances, no, absolutely not. And so that's what and it allows the parties to agree in other circumstances. So that's what 5 and 6 and Sections 10 and 11 do in this bill. So back to Apprendi and Blakely. Section 7 amends the sentencing provisions for murder in the first degree to specifically exclude the language that allows the court to find by clear and convincing evidence that, for example, the defendant subjected the murder victim to substantial torture. Because when That sentence is that mandatory 99 years is imposed, you lose your ability to get mandatory parole in good time. So that does, that factual determination raises the maximum penalty that can be imposed on that person. So we have to take these out of our statute. And it's a good idea to do it because, you know, judges in the heat of the moment sometimes don't think about court decisions. And so it's a good idea to clean up our statutes to reflect what is required by the Constitution. Section 8 codifies the requirements of Blakely and Apprendi for persons convicted of murder in the first degree or the intentional death of an unborn child who aren't entitled to good time too, and for other, the imposition of presumptive terms that require a particular factual finding, such as for a Class A felony, if a person is found to have been in possession of a firearm or have used a dangerous instrument in the commission of the crime, they get a different presumptive range than does a person who didn't under the circumstances. So this clarifies that those decisions about whether or not that person did possess a firearm or use a dangerous weapon have to be decided by the jury, unless waived by the defendant, by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. If you have questions, please interrupt me. Section 9 codifies the requirements Section 9 addresses a couple of aggravating factors that have caused some confusion in the courts, and we thought it was worthwhile clarifying in statute. And that the first one deals with the aggravating factor of the person's conduct was the most serious in the definition of the offense. And this specifies that the factual finding of what the defendant's conduct was must be submitted to the jury unless waived and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. But then the legal decision about whether or not that conduct was the most serious in the definition of the offense is left to the judge. And this codifies that provision.
Well, I do have a question.
Yes.
Because now I can't remember all the reading I did this summer and again this winter. Remind me how this will work in a case, let's just use assault in the first degree. Person's charged with assault in the first degree, which is intentionally causing a serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument, and you know, you decided that this was, you know, almost attempted murder. I mean, it was, you know, just, you know, an intentional shooting of, you know, someone with a handgun or a rifle or something else, and you decided this is most serious. Walk me through sort of how the jury will make a decision, how the judge will make a decision, and when.
Okay. All of these allow the judge to make decisions on the procedure in each individual case, but this is how I envision it. We'd give notice that we plan to claim this aggravating factor, and we would ask the court, after the jury has returned a guilty verdict, to consider making specific findings on the conduct of the defendant. For example, in your example, if a person beat another person within an inch of his or her life and caused permanent brain damage, we would ask the fact finder to make that determination, and then we would ask the judge to conclude that based on those facts, this is the most serious in the definition of the offense.
So in the first case with the jury, I mean, do you have to charge that at grand jury? Do you have to say to the grand jury, we want an indictment on assault in first degree, and we want you to say it's, you know, in the most, you know, among the most serious assaults in this category?
No, I don't. At this point, we are not required under the decisions of the court to do that.
So at what point does the jury get this decision, the trial jury?
Well, first of all, they'll get the evidence for the underlying charge, and then if we ask them to make specific findings, we would ask them to make specific findings based on their conduct and how it affected a victim.
So they would take an additional verdict form back with them and fill it out, yes or no, is this most serious?
They wouldn't decide if it's most serious. They would just make the factual findings. Then we would ask the judge to do that. And the reason for that is it's difficult for one trial jury in one particular case to compare
what's most serious.
And probably the easiest, and it would, it's unlikely that it would come up, but the easiest example is theft. You know, see felony theft is between $500 and $25,000. If a person is charged with theft, a felony, see felony, and they're convicted, and the value of the property or the amount of money stolen was $24,900. That would be the most serious in the definition of the offense.
Sure, sure. And you would just submit the form to the jury saying, did he steal $25,000? And they say yes, and the judges say, look, they've found $25,000. I know from my legal training that that's most serious, so you're ready to go. Mm-hmm. So how does it work in assault?
An assault would be, you know, we would say...
What factual finding would the jury make? I guess I still...
That, for example, that the harm caused to the victim paralyzed him or her or caused life, you know, whole life injuries that the person from which the person would never recover.
So it's not a defined element in the criminal law, but
no.
It's an aspect of sort of proving up that it's a serious assault.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Now I understand. Further questions?
I have one question, and I don't practice criminal law, so, but it goes to the guy that didn't want to be on probation and asked that the judge put him in jail for longer. That's the way I understood it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was the problem? In other words, as I understand, the guy agreed at original sentencing, 5 months in jail and 19 months on probation. He gets out, he violates a term of probation, and he just says, screw it, I don't want to be on probation. Put me in jail for 15 months or whatever it is, but when I get out, I'm off probation, which the 15 months seems substantially longer than the court would have given just for the alcohol consumption. What was the problem there? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pascoe, in that particular case, the sentence was 3 years probation.
Okay.
And 19 months of suspended jail time. He said he didn't want to be on probation, and he had agreed, you know, he had said when he entered the plea agreement that he would serve 3 years of probation, and he got a substantial benefit. Three serious charges were dismissed in exchange for his agreement to serve 3 years probation. He didn't like probation, and so he decided that he asked the court to eliminate probation and send him back to jail. Well, you know, if he had sent him back to jail for 19 months, as the original bargain had been, that would have been fine, because at that point he had served everything that he had agreed to, and there wasn't any much point after that for him to be on probation. But the judge not only reduced the time that he had agreed to, but also suspended any probation after that. So, you know, I suppose if the judge had said, I'm going to send you to jail for 15 months, you'll still have 4 months and whatever's left of probation, that would have been fine. But the judge not only reduced the amount of time that was suspended and to serve, but unilaterally eliminated the rest of the probation.
You know, so what for, I can't remember what the blood alcohol concentration level was, but what would have the likely jail time have been for that probation violation as compared to the 15 months that the judge actually, you know, sentenced him?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pascoe, I'll find out. I don't know what the practice is what that likely period
would be. I can't resist. I'll just take a stab at it and say my guess is on a first-time, felony probation revocation for having been found in consumption of alcohol after having with a sentence, I'll say something around 2 months. He'd get 2 months of time in post. He would serve his 2 months or 40 days. He'd come out, but he would still have 17 months suspended over his head for the next 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
See, he would just, and, you know, a lot of times you just sort of chip those little sentences away until at some point everybody throws up their hands and says, I'm flat timing you. But you get all the time. You don't get a reduction in that time just because you're a problem or because it doesn't look like we can fix you. Does that make sense? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. Well, I support the provision. I mean, I think it makes sense because what you're trying to do is not allow sort of the criminal to come back behind and remove the benefit of the bargain that the state got, essentially in protecting the public. Because, you know, what you're saying is we get a benefit by having you on probation for 3 years. That protects us because what the issue is, you have a problem with alcohol.
Right.
And we want you to not consume alcohol, and we believe in you not doing that. We're probably going to remove the harm that you present to society. And so I believe that that's the right thing to do. But I guess it just brings me to one other point, Mr. Chairman. Maybe later on in the year we can come back to this. Is that we, you know, this cycle that we talk about? Are we rehabilitating these folks when they come in and out? So I guess I say to myself, boy, that's an alcoholic that says I'd rather go 15 months in jail and be able to come out and drink myself into oblivion and drive when I want and do whatever I want. Wow. And that's just unreal. But while he's in there for 15 months, what are we doing by way of alcohol rehabilitation? And I'd love us to get some updates on that to really think about, in a small, you know, 710,000 humans, that's all we have. I feel like there's some real possibility here that we can think through our system better. We spoke of it in the last bill that we had, and I'm broadening my remarks here, but, you know, as we think about this one human being who presents the exact problem that Annie spoke about, it's essentially putting a loaded weapon out in our community. Somebody who says, I will drink to the point of 2.57 and get in a car and drive, and I will mow over your kids, I'll mow over you, I don't care. So better to have them in jail. I understand that. Or on probation and you can't drink. But what are we doing to solve that person? And I don't know. I hope we at some point can think more about that as a committee. Are we sending them back out rehabilitated? Or while they're on probation, is part of that probationary period, you know, going on naltrexone or whatever the current medication is to affect the serotonin and to change behavior?
Mm-hmm. Well, through the chair, I know that there are a lot of programs available. I'm sure, I'm sure it's hard for a person who is obviously that addicted to stay away from alcohol. But there are therapeutic courts, there are treatment. I'm no expert in the treatment programs, but we certainly have programs available. I don't know whether he was, I don't know his situation, but I could find out, see if he was.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't expect Annie to be it. I bring this example up for us to focus on later on to say, you know, as we're looking at it, what are the programs available for somebody that's on probation? And by the way, is it something that judges can require when somebody's on probation, more than just saying someone's going to pop in and test your blood alcohol level? We have now ankle monitors that can test the blood alcohol level, which is great. But what treatment are we getting? And then vice versa, if someone says, fine, I'll just take the jail time, okay, but then are we requiring them to go through alcohol treatment while they're there so that we actually change that person's behavior so that we're not just releasing another loaded weapon?
Through the chair, I can find out what all the conditions of probation were in that case. And I know two of them, the two that he violated was one was possessing and drinking, and I think he was also ordered not to have contact with other felons, and he was arrested. He was with another person who was convicted of a felony. But, there were others, I'm sure, other conditions that he, I just don't know them right now.
Senator Cockhill.
To the aggravating factor, you started an explanation. I thought I got it, and then I don't think I got it. So,
okay.
What I understand under this circumstance, once we get to the place where the jury has made a decision beyond a reasonable doubt.
Oh, just for a point of order, just so everyone's following, we're back on, we've moved back to section 9. Okay,
yeah.
Okay, great.
So we get a place where the crime was shown to be what it was beyond a reasonable doubt. The way I understand Blakely, the aggravator had to be a part of the discussion coming into the verdict, and then the court gets to make some discretionary based on this other standard of reasonable doubt. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Through the chair, generally at trial, the state is required to prove every element of the crime charged beyond a reasonable doubt. And then when there's a determination of guilt and you go to the sentencing phase, then the prosecution would, I mean, I'm sure some of the evidence is already admitted in the underlying trial for the whether or not the person is guilty, but additional evidence could be then submitted to the trial jury. And just for an example, I'll read you the crime of assault in the first degree. A person commits the crime of assault in the first degree, one, if that person recklessly causes serious physical injury to another person by means of a dangerous instrument. The way we've drafted our criminal statutes, they're fairly generic. We don't say, you know, has broken their arm or, you know, various other things. We define serious physical injury as injury that can cause harm for a long period of time or disfigurement or something. But that conduct could include, you know, somebody hitting you with a car and breaking your leg, or it could also include somebody, you know, maiming a person for their life or, you know, impairing their life forever and their ability to have children and to raise children. I mean, there's a real big range there. And that's why, you know, in the old days, judges had really broad discretion in sentencing a person. Now they have ranges. And if they want to go beyond the ranges that are set in statute, we need to prove aggravating factors. Or if they want to go below the ranges, the defense needs to prove mitigating factors.
And Mr. Chairman, I somewhat remember that discussion of why the aggravators were put in there. But under the Blakely, those things had to be shown before the final sentencing, if I remember correctly now. And so that's why I was wondering if it was the jury's discretion or if it was the court's discretion or both, you know, how they fit together.
Mr. Chairman, before the Blakely and decision and Apprendi, although I'm not very good at, but what would happen in our state is the person would be found guilty, and then there would be a sentencing hearing, and we would file aggravating factors, and the defense would file mitigating factors, and there would be a hearing before the judge, who would find these whether or not he or she found these to be present by clear and convincing evidence, and the Blakely decision was clear that we couldn't do that anymore. So that's when we had a pretty serious revision of our sentencing law. And now we have ranges, and in order to go above or below those ranges, we have to prove aggravating factors beyond a reasonable doubt.
And I was just wondering how far the jury is involved in that proof, that need.
The defendant has a right for the jury to determine factors. And the law is a little bit different because if an aggravating factor is, for example, a prior conviction, then we don't need to take it to the jury to decide because the jury has already decided that. But the aggravating factors like the defendant was particularly cruel or, you know, devoted his, you know, chose a victim based on a vulnerable factor like the person was intoxicated or an older person, those are aggravating factors that the jury has to decide now since these Supreme Court decisions.
And that's what I was trying to get at. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to get my brain right because I read it and it looked to me like the court got some of that discretion, and then it looked like other times where the jury had to have that, and that helped that discussion.
Good.
Senator Pascoe.
Just to follow up on Senator Coghill's, I think I understand, but if so, the prosecutor waits for the jury to come back with the finding of guilty of whatever that charge was. And then if they have the determination that if the guilty verdict comes back and they're going to seek an aggravator, then I assume they have to keep that jury there.
That's correct.
And send back that jury saying, with your finding of guilt, you now must determine beyond a reasonable doubt this additional fact, whether that's true or not.
Yes, that's correct.
At that time.
Yes.
I think that's what
more helpful.
Although, you know, we have to give notice before trial that we were going
Right, so that, yeah, there's notice and opportunity to be heard. So both the prosecution and the defense counsel know that immediately if the jury finds guilt, that the prosecution is then going to say, we are going to seek whatever the fact might be, mm-hmm. defense counsel's ready, they send the jury back in after whatever factual presentation, and then wait for a second jury verdict on that specific issue, but the same jury.
Yes.
Okay.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just as an example, there's a whole, there's 20, there's 34 aggravators. We've done a good job of putting aggravators in the statute. There's lots of aggravators. One of the easier aggravators to figure out is this one, number 6. The defendant's conduct created a risk of imminent physical injury to 3 or more persons other than accomplices. So you're saying at the end of the trial, on this assault trial, if this assault trial was the firing of a handgun in a crowded mall, you go back and say, okay, jury, what do you think? Was there a risk of imminent physical injury to 3 or more persons? And they come back and say yes, and you go to sentencing. But you don't have to take that to grand jury.
No.
Okay. It's just post guilty verdict.
Yes. Okay. But we do have to give notice that if there's a guilty
right,
verdict.
Right. But this particular aggravator we're dealing with, most serious, in Section 9, that's just been giving you some troubles because of its nature, because it's just not sort of reducible to a.
Yes, it's a difficult one, and that's why we thought it would be good to codify what we think is the law in this area.
Senator Pastor.
Just a point of clarification. If there was a finding of guilty and that jury was discharged, and then the prosecutor later says, I think we have an aggravator that we can prove, can they then, I know they're not going to bring back the prior jury, but could they constitute a second jury on that issue, or is there a lock-in as to that original jury?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think we could do that, or we would. I don't think we can, because if we haven't given notice of it at that point, I think we've probably lost it.
That before the jury renders its ultimate determination as to guilt or innocence, the prosecutor has to make the determination as to whether they may prove an aggravator.
Yes.
Okay. I think that maybe goes more directly
to you.
And then if the jury then determines that it is a proven aggravator, then the judge has the range or latitudes of what the sentence might be.
Yes, a finding of an aggravating factor allows the judge to go to the maximum term for that offense. And that goes into the very last portion of this bill, if you'd like me to just explain the very last section.
I'm glad you brought this all back up, because it actually reminds me of my irritation with the Blakely decision in the first place, which was, I thought, it's a long discussion, but I think it needlessly tied the hands of prosecutors and judges, but here we are.
Yes, it was a little bit discouraging, and I think it was discouraging to the defense bar too, because anyway, for a number of reasons, it was discouraging.
We've got Doug Moody on the line. He may be able to enlighten us.
He might. I hope I'm accurate in everything I'm telling you, but if I'm not, he'll correct me. And the very last one is J on page 4, line 31. And that codifies a couple of decisions in our law that it says that once an aggravating factor has been determined by law, whether it's by a jury making the findings necessary or by the fact that there's a prior conviction that is an aggravating factor, and that doesn't have to be by a jury, once one has been decided according to law, that raises the maximal penalty to the top. We don't have to go through that procedure for others. The court
we only need one.
Yeah, only need one to get to that point. So that has been decided by a couple of decisions, and I'm happy to provide them. Or I think they're in the summary of or the sectional. So there it is. I really appreciate your listening to it. It's awfully technical and
I actually thought you did a good job, and the committee questions helped bring it all to mind. So. Further questions for Ms. Carpinetti? Don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
We do have Doug Moody on the line from the Public Defender Agency. Mr. Moody, are you there?
I'm here, Mr. Chair.
We would, if you put yourself on the record, we'd be happy to hear your views on the bill.
This is Douglas Moody, Deputy Director of the Public Defender Agency. First, I'd like to talk about Section 9, the Blakely one that's received so much discussion. I disagree with Ms. Carpinetti's assessment. I think that this section is going to create a constitutional problem. It's going to leave the statute open to constitutional attack under federal constitutional law. Blakely made these aggravating factors an element of the offense, basically. They said the offense is one thing if your sentence, if your statutory sentencing range is X, but if you are bringing in a factor that elevates it above the otherwise maximum, that's basically an element of the offense. That's why it has to get proven to a jury. When you take in, what this Section 9 tries to do is take it out of it being an element of the offense. That what the jury is supposed to do is find whether it's the most serious offense or among the most serious conduct within the definition of the offense. And what the state wants to do is say, well, you can the jury can just decide X, you know, fact X and fact Y, and the judge will decide whether it's most serious or not. But that's like saying in any other element of the offense, well, the robber came into the store, the guy came into the store, he had a gun, he pointed the gun, he took some money out of the till, and he left. But they're not the jury doesn't get to find out whether he was guilty of robbery or not. They just say, find these facts. And that's not the way it goes. I mean, it's an element. The jury finds that he committed the act of robbery by the proof of these facts. And I think juries are capable, are just quite capable of making these decisions. One of the examples that Ms. Carbonet was talking about was most serious on assault cases and your most serious physical injury. There's a huge range of conduct that can, or injuries that sort of fall into that most serious. They're given a general definition and they decide whether the actual facts, you know, the specific injury, does a cracked bone act, is that serious physical injury? Because in some instances, a cracked bone really may have no impact on a guy's life, may not have any lasting complications, might have, you know, a week or two's worth of pain. On the other hand, a different cracked bone could lay you up, you know, if it's in the spine, could lay you up for months. So it sort of depends. And juries are fully capable of making those decisions. And I think what this tries to do is take an element of the offense out of the realm of the, or out of the hands of the jury and put it in the hands of the judge. And I think given the United States Supreme Court's rather consistent support of Blakely, and given the makeup of the court, I don't think it's likely to change. And I think that poses a federal problem, federal constitutional problem. Sort of along the same lines.
Why don't we stay in Section 9, just to, you know, kind of deal with that, and then we can go to other sections so it's all at once. Senator Passman has a question, then I have one.
Sure.
My question really is focused in Section 9. Is it subsection I that is the constitutional problem, or is it J, or is it both?
Both. I think I is a problem because it attempts to take the proof of the element or the decision on whether the element has been proven away from the jury and give it to the judge by trying to split this decision somehow between facts on one hand and then a quote legal conclusion on the other. I think that's a directly in conflict with Blakely. J, I think, is a problem. The Court of Appeals has said a couple of times just what Ms. Carpinetti said, that when defendants have appealed their sentence and said these aggravators were not presented to the judge, you know, you have to reverse the sentence. And the judge goes, well, the trial judge, the Court of Appeals has said, the trial judge could have imposed this very same sentence because he found this one aggravator properly. So the fact that he didn't find the other ones properly doesn't make any difference. You know, harmless error, sort of. The problem with this statute, and actually I think the problem with Court of Appeals case, is that judges get to weigh the weight that they're going to give any particular aggravator. And some aggravators, are judges give them a whole lot of weight, because of the specific facts of the case. As an example, a defendant before the court may have had some prior misdemeanor assaults, okay? And, you know, was a scrappy lad earlier in his youth and has some misdemeanor assaults. Well, that can form the basis of an aggravator for repeated assault of conduct. But if he's before the court on a felony DUI because he's got a problem with drinking and driving, the court is, like most trial courts, are not going to give a great deal of weight to the assault of conduct. They want to know what was the conduct involved in this DUI. You know, and it's the fact that it's a felony means he's not getting the message. And they're going to focus on what was the driving like. You know, things like that, and focus on that, and not give much weight. So if you take away, if you say, well, if one aggravator is found, then you don't have to submit the other ones to a jury, then some guy, the judge would be making a decision on whether this was the most serious kind of felony DUI, instead of presenting it to a jury, merely because the guy has some misdemeanor assaults in his background, where that conduct isn't really related to the DUI. And that's because of the judge, you know, not all aggravators are weighed the same in each case. Judge has to sort through them. And it's fairly typical for judges to say, I'm not giving these aggravators much weight. I'm giving a lot of weight to this one. And typically, most serious conduct is the aggravator that the courts pay the most attention to because that's the one that deals with the offense at hand.
Let me ask you about that.
I and Jay both.
Yeah, sure. Let me ask you about that. I mean, let's set aside Jay. And let's just focus on I for a second, the most serious aggravator. You're saying that's the one that gets the most weight. How is that aggravator being proved right now? What's the procedure in an assault trial for getting the most serious aggravator proved up?
I'd have to run downstairs and grab a felony trial lawyer to answer the question. I've been doing appeals and management for too long.
Okay.
And so I really can't tell you how the state's proving it at this point.
Okay.
And I haven't seen it in any of the appeals I've dealt with.
Okay. And we may just hold this. So, I mean, the bill is going to be held over. I'm curious about sort of how the state's doing it now. And So we'll set that in abeyance. We'll hold that in abeyance for the time being. So any more questions for Mr. Moody on Section 9?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Just a brief one, and we don't have to answer it today, but he said we could run afoul of constitutional issues, and I'd like to kind of have articulated to me in kind of layman's terms what the principle would be, the tilt. Would it be the discretion to the judge, or that there might be in a guilty charge, they would have to find within a range of guilt or, degrees of guilt. What would be that principle that he would struggle constitutionally on? And that would help me understand that. And I don't.
Well, actually, let's hold on, Doug. Hold on. Go ahead.
I don't need the question answered today either. But on page 5 in, I guess that's section J. I don't understand what that last sentence means where it says if an additional aggravating factor may be then established by clear and convincing evidence by the court without a jury, including an aggravating factor that the jury has found not to have been established beyond a reasonable doubt. So the clear and convincing is a lower standard, and so I don't understand how that operates. So if the jury's already said it isn't proven by beyond a reasonable doubt, what's going on and how does that work?
We will, we'll keep that uppermost in our minds, but as to Senator Coghill's question about constitutionality, Doug, do you have a kind of a short, crisp rationale for why you think there's constitutional problems in Section 9?
Yes, Senator Coghill, through the chair. The basic rationale is the federal constitutional right to a jury trial. The court has said that the right to a jury, part of that right is the right to have every element of the offense proven to the jury. The jury gets to decide each element of the offense. And what the, in the old days, you know, you had the element of the offense and then the judge would decide whatever sentence was imposed. And in Blakely, and then over the years, different systems, you know, the Alaska developed its presumptive sentences, the federal system developed its, you know, complex range sentencing scheme. And what the court said is, well, if you, they interpreted some of those things that we considered sort of sentencing factors historically as elements of the offense. If it changes the maximum sentence that could be imposed by the judge, then it's considered an element of the offense, and the right to a jury trial, your right to a jury trial, means that that element must be decided by the jury.
So thank you, Mr. Moody. I'm going to state it in how I understand it. So the right to the jury to discern the elements of the crime and their egregiousness over against the judge's sentencing discernment, basically, discretion. That's how I see it.
I think that's right. I think it's basically making sure the jury stands between the defendant and the judge's sentence, and the jury has to bless each one of those aspects. Senator Passman.
Is another way of looking at this, and again, I don't practice law in this area, but we have assault 1, 2, or 3, and they, you know, lesser categories. But if you're in assault 1, if you prove these aggravating factors, essentially there's a new crime called assault in the first degree plus.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is whether the jury has to prove that plus.
Okay.
That's kind of the way I'm reading it.
That's about right. And just to, not to rehash Blakely, but the grief that many people felt was that assault in the first degree is a Class A felony, punishable by 20 years. And a lot of people thought if you get convicted of assault in the first degree, you can get 20 years. And it turns out you can't unless you prove some aggravators. And the aggravators now have to go to a jury. But Mr. Moody, we interrupted you in your discussion of the bill, so please go ahead.
Let me see. What else? Okay. I think through the chair, Mr. Chair, the only other thing I was going to comment on was on Section 6 on page 3 that deals with revoking probation and imposing the suspended portion of the sentence. The fact that the courts, trial judges, have had the discretion to terminate a defendant's probation earlier than the end, than the original length of probation, and just take them off probation early and impose some but not all of the originally imposed sentence, isn't something new that was decided in the Henry decision. That's been around at least since 1997 in the DiMario case, that trial courts have not just have the discretion, but they have the duty to reevaluate a sentence and then decide what is the, given the original conduct and the client's conduct on probation, and that includes a client's unwillingness to do probation or to work with a probation officer, and then impose a just and fair sentence in light of the Cheney criteria. I think the split comes, sort of the dissonance here, is that when a person gets sentenced, even pursuant to Rule 11 agreement, with a certain amount of time to do up front and then a certain amount of jail time that is suspended, a defendant is bargaining for the jail sentence, but what happens when you have suspended time is you get less time up front, more time, you get a longer overall sentence than if you were just to go into court and say, give me a flat time sentence. And at the probation level, what the court is doing is measuring the overall sentence against what it would have given if it had given the defendant a flat time sentence. That means just all jail time, no suspended time, at the time that they originally committed the offense, or their original sentence, and also any additional time that is warranted for their behavior or misbehavior, as the case may be, while on probation. And it may be that a court looks at it and says, yes, given the facts of this case, when they, a total sentence that takes into consideration, a just and fair sentence that takes into consideration the original violation of law, the DUI that Ms. Carpenter was talking about, and say any misbehavior on probation, a just and fair sentence of all just jail time is X. And maybe it is less than the total, of the originally imposed suspended time plus the amount that was suspended. Mostly, generally speaking, it's not. The judges don't do that very often. But it is possible, certainly in the Henry case, that's what the court decided. Both the trial court and the court of appeals concluded that it was an appropriate sentence. And what this does is it allows the court to sort of evaluate whether this was the propriety of the deal. When a court approves a Rule 11 agreement, it's supposed to evaluate the propriety of the deal. Well, the court has historically not reviewed suspended time because on the theory that we're not going to review the length of the guy's suspended time because he hasn't done anything wrong, and he may never do anything wrong, and we're not going to worry about it until he does mess up and come back before the court. And so, this is a long history of the court sort of treating it, of both the court, trial court and the appellate courts treating it this way. And so what you have, what this is going to do is it's sort of taking out that review. Because a guy comes in, pleads, gets, 5 months to serve and another 19 months suspended, and, it looks to the judge, it looks okay, but he can't really say whether a 24-month sentence would be appropriate as a flat-time sentence based on the guy's future conduct, because the future conduct hasn't occurred. There are sort of multitudes of reasons why guys don't want to finish out on probation. the least common of which is I just want to drink all the time. Far more common is I want to move to a different part of the state because I can find work. Some guys just don't want to be on probation. They want to be stuck in Anchorage. They want to go back to a village or something like that. So you have all these other reasons why somebody might not want to be on probation anymore. But the way the law is now and has been for a long time is that the judge just comes in and determines what is a fair and just sentence given the entire scope of conduct. And frankly, usually that means the guy gets everything. Henry's sort of a very atypical case where we, the defense bar, convince a judge that to impose less. It happens, but it's not the rule. And I think you've potentially got a problem here in stripping the court of that discretion to review it.
Mr. Moody, thank you. I'm sensitive to that last argument. I think there is, I at least have some concerns about the discretion issue. Judges are the fact finders. They are on the ground. They are looking at the totality of the circumstances. On the other hand, I'm sensitive to the idea this is a bargain that was struck knowingly on both sides. And once you strike that bargain, it seems like it's... it just may be not fair to deprive the state of what it felt it bargained for. So, this is still in front of the committee. Senator Passman.
The duty to reevaluate, where is that? I mean, I don't think we have that before us.
Probably not in this, statute, but I'm sure there's plenty of cases that say that when a defendant comes in front of the judge on a probation revocation, he or she, the judge, has the duty to, why don't you tell me, Mr. Moody, instead of me just guessing?
I happen to have the DeMario case up on my computer.
Very good.
And it says, the Court of Appeals said in 1997, it is well settled that when the trial court revokes probation, it may not automatically impose all previously suspended time. Instead, the court must carefully reevaluate all currently available information in light of the Cheney criteria. The court's sentence must be based on the totality of the circumstances, including the original offense, the offender, and the offender's intervening conduct. These sentencing principles apply with equal force to situations in which the defendant refuses probation. The defendant's refusal of a probationary term cannot in itself be given determinative consideration. And there were some intermediate cites to older cases in there that I omitted. But that's been the case law for a long time in the state.
Thank you for that swift judicial citation. Senator Passman.
In essence, the question is can we statutorily change that? Isn't that the question?
I'll just say I don't think we're saying I don't think we're changing that. I just think we're saying what they can't do is, I mean, he can, the judge is always free to say, in the totality of circumstances, I think it's worth X many days of the suspended time. But what he can't do is say, I've decided that the suspended time imposed in the first place was too much and eliminate it. And maybe, Mr. Moody, you want to chime in on this question as well.
Mr. Chair, well, I think that's exactly what this provision does, is say the judge can't do that. I mean, we were back in 97, we were doing Rule 11 agreements, and this was the background. This is the background law that all Rule 11 agreements were entered into, including in the one in Kenai that formed the basis of the Henry decision, is that when a person comes before a court on a revocation, the court will reevaluate in totality. And, I'd like to respond, if I may, Mr. Chair, to a comment you made about the bargaining. And
Please go ahead.
The bargain, the defendant. One of the problems with the whole contract theory as applied to plea bargains is that the two sides are not in equal bargaining power. My clients are usually in jail when they're making the bargain, and frequently the bargain will get them out of jail. Like the bargain in the Henry case, 24 months with 19 months suspended, 5 months to serve. That sounds very much like a deal that would have been presented to Mr. Henry, and he would have gotten out of jail at that point. And clients are always, it's a deal is presented that gets them out of jail. And they'll always take more jail time than I would recommend, or than I think a court would impose, if it gets them out right now. And that's what, I don't think the state is being I think the state's just using the power that they have to get the deals that they want. I mean, they know that a client wants out of jail. They offer a deal that will let the client get out of jail. They know that clients will take longer probation. I mean, that's just the way it is, and it's not really an equal bargaining position. And that's why I think it's entirely appropriate to have a judge always there to reevaluate the fairness and the justness of the entire composite, the entire whole sentence.
Doug, thank you. I think we've gotten a good bright light shined on this section and the philosophical debate about it. And we're not moving the bill today. The committee will have plenty of time to think it over before we take final action. Any wrap-up comments you want to make?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we will now turn to a what I had thought might be a conceptual amendment by Senator Coghill, and it may indeed be. It's an idea he's brought to me and has discussed over the years. And so let's turn to Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, what I have is an amendment prepared relating to property crimes. And it's probably a good place to put it in this bill when we talk about sentencing and what a felony is. This deals with the property crime limits, and I think it's something worth looking at. And just as a matter of procedure, Mr. Chairman, there's two ways I could do it. I could just hand it out as something for the committee to study before I move it, because it's got several pages to it. But in essence, what it does is it takes kind of a 1970s numbers and tries to put them into the new century. Mm-hmm. And it really falls under the category of we have some people doing $200 or $500 felonies that are living in courts where people have done serious personal damage to people.
Let's do this just procedurally. Let's just for the purposes of this discussion call it a conceptual amendment.
Okay.
And it's before us as a conceptual amendment. You've got a nice piece of paper to back it up, but it's not formally offered and so not formally objected to, but go ahead.
Okay, fine.
Great.
Fine. I just wanted to bring it to your attention. I think it's a worthwhile discussion. You know, when we had both the Crime Summit and some of the people come before us on really the crimes, personal crimes to vulnerable adults, especially children, it just once again squeezed my heart to the point where I'm thinking, you know, a felony is a serious, serious matter. And we have these property crimes issues where now, probably in the 70s, $500 would have bought a whole fleet of bicycles. Today it would buy a single bicycle. And I'm asking a question, are we sure that's a felony nowadays? And I don't think so. And so you'll look at several limits. We went from $500 to $1,500. We went from $50 to $200 on some property crimes. And what I can do is, I can give you maybe a one-page rationale for that, but this shows it how it would actually land in statute so that you could have a good look at it.
It's amazing how many different sections it touches. If you want to make this adjustment, you got to touch a lot of different parts of the law. Remind me when the last time was that we adjusted these numbers, or when were these numbers adopted?
These were adopted in 1978.
1978. And they have sat there ever since.
Yes.
And in general, if we adjusted these numbers to inflation, where would they be?
They would be quite a bit higher. Where I have 1,500 would be probably closer to 2,500.
2,500, wow. And this has, does this, I know it's aimed at sort of the misdemeanor felony cutoff line, but does it also go up the ladder to B felonies and A felonies? Or do you just, are you just focused on the misdemeanor felony cutoff?
That's where I had my primary focus was.
Sure.
To try to, you know, we got to be careful of making everything a felony.
Right.
I wanted to make sure if it's really a felony. I don't want to look soft on crime, but I also want to be real about crime.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is some of these things now, in my view, don't merit what we have now made felonies to be. You know, a year in jail and restitution, quite frankly, for property crimes, to me would be a greater value than just putting somebody under the kind of the felony lock that we put them in these days. So that was my main purpose, is to move the misdemeanor level into where we have now wandered into being felonies.
Yeah, there's a good example on page 4. As I was asking the question and flipping through the conceptual amendment, I see a good example on page 4 where both the issuing a bad check and the fraudulent use of an access device, you are not moving the Class B felony amount. It's still $25,000 or more. But right now you've got a pretty big gap. The C felony covers from $500 to $24,999. And this will just move that up to $1,500.
Right.
And expand the misdemeanor area a little bit. What conversations have you had with law enforcement and the Department of Law and other folks?
Mr. Chairman, I've had some positive conversations with the Department of Law. I don't know that they're ready to run out and be my advocates yet, but I haven't had as much pushback. I have had some pushback in some areas where we really do have some vulnerable adults, and I think that's a legitimate discussion where you might have, say, seniors who have been taken advantage of. But I think restitution, really, or some other way of dealing with it rather than just putting a felony in it, it is important. So probably the biggest question I've had is just the discussion we were talking about here, and that is, under the plea bargaining circumstances, it's always nice to be able to have a felony over somebody to bargain into a misdemeanor, and the property crimes is one place to do that. And I can appreciate there's a lot of frustration in Alaska where investigations for property crimes seem to lag behind many others, whether it's domestic violence or whatever. And so I can understand some frustration, but this is one of those things where I say, you know, kind of the truth in charging, too. It really has to be about what the crime really is. And so I'm putting it on the table for discussion. And what I'll try to do is I'll try to do a one-page summary of this so that, because it does touch a lot of areas. But I saw this bill coming. I had a day and a half to prepare for it. So I'm probably not even making my best argument at this point.
Actually, just for the record, you brought it forward at my encouragement, and so I appreciate you doing that. It's going to be controversial. I'm not sure which way the committee wants to go. You know, there's sort of the soft on crime argument, but there's also the $250 million prison we're opening, and the argument that we could have put a lot more money into the BSA today if we hadn't built that prison. Senator Pastner.
I generally like the concept, and I applaud Senator Coghill for bringing it forward. And again, I think it's part of the process. If you're convicted of a misdemeanor, you're still convicted of a crime. And it's not, you know, it's not like we're letting anyone off. And so I think the ultimate question here is at what point do we realistically say you're still going to be a criminal, but you're not going to be a felon? You're going to be convicted of a crime less than that felony level, and we're just bringing it on an inflation proofing, and even less, as the senator has indicated, than if we were to just raise it. So, I mean, I think the concept is appropriate.
Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chair, I'd be curious if we could get numbers from law or someone as to how many people would have been impacted in the recent year, recent couple of years? Is that at all possible?
I don't know, but I can find out whether it's possible.
Thank you.
Or even maybe the court system could tell us just on a, it wouldn't even have to be a sort of a deep statistical analysis, but just sort of a spot anecdotal check. You know, look at the last three convictions for felony theft and see what the amount was, you know, and that may help us, you know, help guide our thinking. The other thing I may do is just do some work on looking at what other states do. I'm not sure if you've taken a look at what Washington, Idaho, Montana, and so forth do, but that's all curious. I'm curious about that as well. So we've got a lot to chew on, but it's been a full meeting, and with that, we're going to go ahead and adjourn.